Right, I think we can start. First, I would like to start with an apology. As you may notice, those of you that know me, I'm not Professor Kevin Featherstone. My name is Vasilis Panastiliotis. I'm a senior lecturer at the European Institute here at LSE, and I'm a member of the Hellenic Observatory. Professor Kevin Featherstone was scheduled to chair this event, but unfortunately, due to personal reasons, he could not be here with us today, so he sends the apologies to the speaker and to the audience. So on behalf of the Hellenic Observatory, it's a great pleasure to be able to welcome Dr. Yanos Papandoneou, who is going to speak to us today on the issue, on an issue which is, of course, in everybody's minds, both in Greece, but also increasingly in the Eurozone, the Greek economy and the possible exit strategies from the crisis. Dr. Papandoneou is not new to LSE or to the Hellenic Observatory, although he's not a graduate from LSE. He obtained his PhD from the University of Cambridge. However, over the years, he has maintained close links with the Hellenic Observatory and the London School of Economics, and we had the chance to host him in a number of occasions in public events, both in his capacity as finance minister and later on, in a more academic capacity. I think most of you, at least here, are aware of his background and his record in politics and in managing the Greek economy, at least the Greeks in the audience. Dr. Papandoneou was Minister of National Economy and then Minister of Finance and Economics in Greece from 1994 to 2001. So one can say that he presided over the whole period of fiscal and economic adjustment that led to Greece's accession into the Eurozone, and perhaps also led to the problems that Greece is experiencing today in relation to the accession of the Eurozone. I'm sure we're going to have the chance to debate this issue of whether Greece was ready to join the Eurozone and whether the correct policies have been followed to prevent what is being seen today. When we have the question and answer session, we're going to have plenty of time, I hope, to address a number of questions after the lecture. Besides being finance minister over the period of the so-called Maastricht convergence period, Dr. Papandoneou has also a long history in Greek politics. He was deputy minister of national economy under the government of Andreas Papandreou in the 80s in 1985, which was another period of fiscal adjustment and economic stabilization also at the time. And then after his spell as Minister of Finance, he was Minister of Defense in 2001-2003. Currently, he's president of the Center for Progressive Policy Research, a think tank that works on European economic policy and politics, I guess. And through his activities in the center, he has published a number of policy reports, and of course, over the years, he has published a number of articles and books on Greece and the European economy. As I mentioned already, today's lecture is on a topic that has a high urgency for Greece. The topic is on the possible exit strategies that are available today for Greece and for the Eurozone, I guess, at large. I think Dr. Papandoneou's experience, both in policy making but also in Greek politics, makes him a very qualified speaker to speak on the topic. So without further ado, I want to ask you to join me in welcoming Dr. Papandoneou to speak to us today.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is a particular pleasure to be back at the LSE, see all friends and colleagues, and have the opportunity to address critical issues such as the fate of the Eurozone and Greece's place in it. I would like to thank once again Kevin and Vasilis for organizing these events, and also for creating the framework within this remarkable institution for engaging a wider audience in discussing these issues. Greece's crisis, which is the object of this lecture, is intertwined with the Eurozone crisis, so that exit strategies for Greece cannot be considered, should not be considered in the wider context of the Eurozone crisis. Looking back at the origins of this crisis, it can be argued that the large external imbalances that have been allowed to be built in the Eurozone over the last decade between the core of the Eurozone and the periphery of the Eurozone account for much of the problems we encounter today. During this last decade, we can witness the following phenomenon. in the periphery of Europe, of the Eurozone, in countries like Greece, Portugal, Spain, Italy, and Ireland. Huge external trade deficits have been built. In fact, they have been growing over the years. Well, the opposite exactly happened in the core of the Eurozone, in places like Germany, like Finland, Austria, the northern countries, where surpluses have been persistent throughout this period. So the Eurozone trade accounts offer a mirror image with surplus on the one side in the core and deficits in the other. Now, why this happened? The main reason why this happened is that the competitive position of the southern peripheral Eurozone countries has deteriorated sharply after they entered the Eurozone area in the year 2000. Before that, this was not the case, because before that, all those countries made huge efforts, particularly Greece, to join the euro area. They pursued very restrictive fiscal policies. They implemented very deep structural reforms to improve productivity. But somehow, all these efforts have stopped once they joined the euro area. The opposite happened in the core of the Eurozone. In the core of the Eurozone, Germany particularly, but also other countries, followed very more ambitious policies. Very restrictive fiscal policies, very ambitious reform agendas, particularly in the labor market reform under the Chancellor Schröder and other very important reforms, which have the opposite effect. They reinforce the competitive position of those countries. So this contrast between the core and the periphery produced precisely this kind of result. Now, the effect of this situation was very direct on the generation of this fiscal crisis. As we know in economics, once you have a very big trade deficit, the opposite, this trade deficit is identical in numerical terms with the addition of the public sector and private sector deficits within your economy. In other words, if you spend more than you produce, you need finance for overspending. You need the finance to buy your imports. This invites excess capital from other countries into your country, which is borrowed either by the public sector or the private sector, or both. Arithmetically, if you have a trade deficit, say, equal to 100, then the composition of your private or the domestic borrowing is equal to that number, either 20 plus 80 or 50 plus 50 or 80 plus 20 or whatever. The algebraic result is the same. And this exactly happened within the Eurozone. The trade surpluses of the north, of the core of the economy, of the Eurozone economy, were transferred as excess savings into the periphery of the Eurozone. And these excess savings have been borrowed either by the private sector or the public sector, or both. Now, we distinguish two subgroups of countries within the periphery of the Eurozone. In fiscally responsible countries, the public sector did not engage in excessive borrowing, but the private sector did. Spanish people, Portuguese people, banks and so on borrowed too much money, which they have invested in housing assets, which eventually became bubbles. When the bubbles crashed, they were transformed into bad debts. Then the government of those countries assumed the bad debts, and these somehow were filtered through all these bad debts into the fiscal, the public debt of those countries, creating the conditions for a fiscal crisis. In Greece, on the other hand, which I would call as a fiscally profligate country, the public sector, the government borrowed directly all these excess savings, and then the fiscal crisis was produced in a more direct way. Either way, either indirectly or directly, the huge trade deficits of those countries, which persisted for a long time, have led to the creation of this fiscal crisis. Now, the question is why there has been this deviant behavior on the part of the peripheral countries. The reason is both psychological, social, and also political. The psychological, social explanation is the following. That those countries, once they entered into the euro area, they thought they got the key to paradise. Because after long periods, particularly for Greece, of very high inflation, very high interest rates, currency devaluations, low growth and instability, they thought that by joining a strong currency area, they had to key to have very high levels of prosperity without any further effort. So they ceased to be cautious about fiscal policy. They ceased to open fronts with social security reform or labor market reform or privatizations or whatever else, and they thought that by just enjoying the fruits of stability, they could enjoy a very nice life. Now, in Greece in particular, however, there has been another reason why this happened, is that this social behavior, this kind of psychological reflex of Greeks that life will be easy within the Eurozone, were sustained, tolerated, even encouraged by irresponsible governments, particularly after the year 2004, when the Tsimikas government fell. And these governments engaged in reckless spending, in hiring unnecessary public sector workers, in giving unnecessary subsidies, in sustaining a lifestyle and life spending which goes much above the country's potential. And this, of course, explains the huge trade deficits, the huge external accounts deficits, the excess borrowing, and the translation of this excess borrowing into the huge fiscal debt explosion that has taken place in those years. So much about the history. Now, let us look at the Eurozone side of it. First of all, it is remarkable that 2 years after the eruption of this crisis in Greece, which accounts for no more than 2% of the Eurozone's GDP, Europe's leaders have not found a way to confront the problem, and still less to limit the contagion to other members of the currency union. Now, the explanation, again, is not very difficult to find. The first explanation is that the euro is a unique experiment needing a special treatment. And sometimes it is difficult to locate the special treatment that was needed. There was no textbook in economics which you could open and find the solution, the recipe for the kind of crisis the Eurozone has been under in the last 2 years. You needed original thought, and apparently original thought was missing within the circles of European leadership. The second explanation is equally perplexing, is that suppose you find the right remedies, the politics of implementing the right remedies are extremely, I would say, exceptionally complicated in the Eurozone, because you do have many governments, you have a variable public opinions, you have a very complex way of making decisions, so it is exceedingly difficult to actually translate even the right recipe into effective action. Anyway, the challenge was big and could be described by three words. It's threefold. The first challenge for the Eurozone is to find a way to express, to establish solidarity so as to find the appropriate finance to cover excessive deficits and sovereign debt repayments, Greece, of Italy, of Spain, or wherever they arise. The second challenge was discipline, to establish rules and procedure for preventing or discouraging the emergence of re-emergence of the fiscal imbalances, because you cannot sort of help somebody unless you are sure that he will not repeat the mistakes for which you pay him. And the third thing was stability. We have said before that the root cause of the crisis was lack of competitiveness and huge external account deficits. So the point for the Eurozone is to establish rules and is to reinforce competitiveness and promote macroeconomic policies to curb all these excessive, destabilizing surplus or deficits in the external accounts, which do constitute the root cause of domestic financial imbalances, as we have said, either public or private. So this was the challenge, to reconstruct the governance of the monetary union along these foundations: solidarity, discipline, stability. All this implies something simple and exceptionally difficult. Implies a huge leap forward on the road of economic and political integration of Europe. What does this translate to? I will be brief here because I'm sure you are familiar with the concepts. It does imply, first of all, fiscal federalism. Fiscal federalism implies to unite the functions of fiscal policy, for instance, to issue Eurobonds. This is why they are acknowledged today to be necessary for ensuring the functioning of the European bond market. Because now what happens in Europe is that the investors shun the bonds of the peripheral countries because they are full of risks, and they transfer capital to the bonds of the strong countries, creating a lot of financial disruption and all these huge differences in bond yields. Second, it does imply a substantial expansion of the capital base of the European Financial Facility, which is the bailout fund. Now just 400 billion euros, which is the present capital base, is totally inadequate for convincing the markets that the European Union, that the Eurozone possesses sufficient firepower, the bazooka power that is needed to calm the markets. You need trillions of euros, not billions of euros, to do that. And the third point is the European Finance Ministry, which will monitor fiscal policy, will punish severely and automatically, I would say, the sinners, those who have excessive deficits, intervene directly in the fiscal policy of the failing governments, determine the overall direction of fiscal policy so as to adjust levels of economic activity between those parts of the Eurozone which have surpluses and those parts which have deficits. Obviously, surplus countries should sustain a higher level of economic activity than deficit ones. And lastly, of course, and last but not least, to intervene directly in areas which affect the competitiveness of the Eurozone by pushing forward reforms to make the weaker countries more competitive and also help with the macroeconomic policy context that should accompany these kind of reforms. So much for fiscal federalism. Now, banking federalism. We should create a unified European financial market. This as opposed to the collection of national ones that now exist. This means that fundamental aspects of financial policy, such as regulation, supervision, crisis resolution, deposit guarantee, as well as competition policies, should be subjected to centralized authorities, not to the 17 separate authorities, but to centralized authorities, such as, for instance, the European Banking Authority. And the third point, which concerns the political integration, is that if you want to sustain in the politically legitimate and sustainable way all these federal systems in fiscal policy, in banking policy, you do need to have democratic legitimacy in the centralized authorities which direct these policies. Peoples in Greece, in France, in Finland could not accept a financial czar in Brussels dictating to them what taxes they should pay or what spending they should incur unless this person is accountable in a democratic system. This is exceptionally important. Even national governments cannot impose their will, much less will be the case with bureaucrats, which will be appointed technocrats, not having the democratic legitimacy. So you need a substantial transfer of political authority from national to European institutions, such as reinforcing the European Parliament, there are many ways, and of course, such as electing the president of the European Commission directly from the people, which will give the Commission much more legitimacy than exists today. Now, let's suppose that something like the lines that I have outlined form the desideratum, the desired outcome of this process of economic and political integration. However this is defined, one could arrive at a very simple statement, that the distance between the successive decisions of the European Council in various meetings over the last 2 years concerning the reform of the governance of the Eurozone is vastly inferior to what should be done. What has happened is that the Eurozone leaders have been unable, either because they have not thought about it correctly or because they thought they were unable to implement these measures, to move forward along the road of political and economic integration, and this has exacerbated the market's patience, which have turned to strongly determined speculative attacks, not only on the weaker peripheral economies, but also on core economies, AAA-rated economies like France, whose banking sectors are exposed to the risk of holding peripheral bonds. Besides these delays and the insufficiency of the measures taken, this idea of too little, too late, this idea of muddling through, which unfortunately has characterized the Eurozone leaders in times of crisis, they have also committed amazing errors. Such an error, which is critical for the future, for explaining what happened, is, for instance, the Deauville Agreement 2 years ago between Mrs. Merkel and Monsieur Sarkozy regarding the involvement of the private sector in financing the bailout schemes. Of course, this rests on a very simplistic but morally nice idea that since the banks have lent these indebted countries, the banks should carry part of the cost for bailing them out. This is, of course, very morally correct, and this is very appealing to the electorates of Germany and other countries because the German taxpayers think, look, I mean, the bad bankers will pay for that. I will not pay as much as was called for. But what happened? The leaders thought that Greece, for instance, with a 51% haircut would be a special case, which would not be imitated by other countries. But of course, the investors didn't think that. The investors thought, on the contrary, that what has happened in Greece with the decision for the haircut of 51% is a precedent for what will follow with Spain, with Italy, with other countries. And obviously what they've done is that they dumped the bonds of those countries, which reduced their price and raised their yields, creating all this upheaval. So this is another way of saying that it is not very clever to deviate from a rigorous line in acting on economic policy. If you follow either confused moral precepts or electoral considerations just to please your people that you won't pay for that, but the bankers will pay, eventually you make the people pay more. And this is what is happening now with the French people and the German people and all those who have sustained the leaders in opting for these erroneous decisions, which is amazing. In fact, they have been committed at such a higher senior level of the European leadership. Now, what is happening now is quite obvious. The euro faces a systemic risk, raising doubts about its sustainability. In the context of weakened confidence, markets tend to overlook the progress in fiscal consolidation in Italy or an improved outlook for reform in Greece or wherever else. Rising bond yields are being driven by financial panic and does not take into account rational considerations. The emerging negative feedback loop could easily drive up the cost of bank and government funding, leading obviously to lower economic growth, while raising the risk of defaults, particularly if investors shun, as I suggested above, peripheral countries' bonds on grounds that they are not risk-free. There is an imminent threat to the very existence of the Eurozone, and this obviously calls for immediate and radical action. An eventual breakup of the Union would entail huge economic and social costs, arising mainly from uncontrolled financial disruption, because what will happen, obviously, is that people will move money around depending on how they evaluate risks. Banks and banking systems may collapse. Enormous social costs will be the result, which will also affect, of course, the peoples of the core of the Eurozone, because obviously if Italy or Spain collapse, the same will happen to German banks. And who will bail out the German banks? The very German taxpayer whom supposedly Mrs. Merkel wants to protect. So what needs to be done is a precept that General Colin Powell referred to back in 91 in the course of the first Iraqi war. They asked him, why do you collect so many people and so much equipment to combat Saddam Hussein, who is so small in front of you? He said, I apply the doctrine of overwhelming power. This is the notion of the bazooka weapon, the overwhelming financial power that now the financial markets need in order to overcome the panic and start to think more rationally about what may or may not happen in the Eurozone. However, money alone, however much or unlimited in quantity, is not sufficient to resolve the crisis. As it is evident from the analysis so far, underlying the problems of the governance reform is a lack of trust between the members of the Union. And how this lack of trust is expressed. The expression of solidarity in the shape of either unlimited European Central Bank buying of bonds or issuing Eurobonds, which of course will reduce enormously the cost of borrowing by the over-indebted countries. This expression of solidarity is blocked by the fear of those who give the solidarity that the people at the receiving end, France, Italy, Spain, Portugal, Greece, will fail to pursue agreed fiscal policies and the reform agendas. In other words, they will not fulfill their own part of the contract. This is the lack of trust. As Jens Weidmann, the Bundesbank president, has very sort of correctly and handsomely put it, there is also a risk that you mute the incentives that come from the market. Market interest rates, in other words, financial terror, does play a role in pushing governments towards reforms. And this is not untrue, because if suddenly the spreads for Greece and the other countries fall down to from the stratosphere of 10%+ fall down to 5% or 4%, the temptation for the governments of Greece and Italy and others to forget about reforms will be quite strong. In theory, this problem, that is the lack of trust, is addressed by promoting political integration. That is, by transferring sovereignty for performing these difficult tasks of reform and fiscal rectitude from irresponsible national institutions to more responsible centralized European institutions. But if credible mechanisms for imposing discipline and securing stability are to be created, these sovereign transfers must be quite substantial. They cannot be cosmetic. And here come the problems. Budgetary sovereignty, for instance, is very close to the heart of most parliaments, including the German parliament. Automatic sanctions, an essential element of stability, is opposed by all systematic sinners. I don't know any government in the Eurozone which is a systematic sinner in producing excessive deficits, which has a positive attitude towards automatic sanctions. Even within the European Union, transforming the European Commission into a democratically elected European government with an elected president will significantly reduce the authority and the power of national governments as it is exerted in the Council of Ministers. Now, these resistances added together are reflected in public opinion and parliaments, making the process of winning majorities within these bodies, either public opinion or parliament, extremely tortuous and also very risky. Evidence for this is the fact that back in 2005, the famous project of the European Constitution that was submitted to the French people for ratification was rejected, and this created a great kind of deception within the circles of Europe. Now, these difficulties in pursuing economic and political integration in practice go a long way to explain the present impasse. However, ladies and gentlemen, dear friends, the end game has been reached. Will Europe keep the single currency alive, or let it fade into insignificance by restricting its application to only a handful of countries in the north of the continent, while producing, during this process, enormous social and economic problems? Answering this question cannot wait for long. In a positive perspective, the EFSF should be turned into a bank and have unlimited access to ECB funds, and be able to intervene massively if required in the bond markets, keeping rates down and stabilizing funding conditions. At the same time, decisions should be taken for advancing economic and political integration, announcing the issuance of Eurobonds and setting in motion a process to enact the necessary legal changes, creating a European finance ministry with substantial enforcement powers, and subjected to increased democratic accountability. All these are absolutely necessary here and now to calm the markets, reduce the panic, and restore stability and rationality in the functioning of the Eurozone economy. Such steps, on top of the difficulties we have explained, inevitably ignite fears of moral hazard. In a nationally fragmented Eurozone, will discipline and stability safeguards prove sufficient to set the Union on a steady growth path? Or will they open the way for it to be transformed into the dreaded transfer union? Arguments in favor of this fear is the fact that the Stability and Growth Pact that was negotiated and signed back in the 10 years ago was violated many times, and the first violator, as we know, was Germany itself. And so, so long as effective political power is nationally fragmented, there's always a risk that all these institutional devices to transfer sovereignty and impose discipline and stability in the edifice of the Eurozone may not work. However, political risks, however they are addressed, should be weighted against financial and economic risks. Extended sovereign defaults and bank bailouts, including in the countries and the banking sectors of the North, could carry unacceptable costs while bringing about the collapse of the Eurozone and, most certainly, a global depression. Moreover, in times when we see what economic and social and political anarchy entails in countries like Syria and other countries in North Africa, creating similar conditions of economic, social, and political anarchy and instability in the south of the continent poses broader geopolitical risks of unknown proportions. So much for the Eurozone. Let us now look at Greece. Greece's fate hinges on Eurozone prospects, obviously. The chances for successfully exiting the crisis are maximized within the context of an effective and positive European response. However, even in this benign and fortunate case, it is extremely important for Greece to start delivering concrete results in the reform field in order to qualify for continued assistance and also to qualify for entering into a bigger solution framework if such is the decision of the Eurozone leaders in the next few days or weeks. The adjustment program agreed with the Troika, the European Commission, the Bank and the IMF, was seriously flawed and poorly implemented. It was the worst of both worlds. It was a bad program implemented in an even worse way. It placed too much emphasis on austerity through tax rises and income cuts and too little on reform. Loose planning by all those Euro and IMF bureaucrats and consistent and repetitive implementation failures led to a deep and prolonged recession, which through consistent undershooting of tax receipts prevented a substantial fall in the budget deficit. In the absence of the devaluation weapon, because those people who planned the program for Greece forgot that Greece is a member of the monetary union. You know, it's not a Latin America country which is free to devalue, but is a strong currency area. It belongs to a strong currency area. The reverse priority should be applied. Less austerity and a longer time profile for deficit reduction, alongside, however, with an aggressive and tightly monitored pursuit of reforms so as to accelerate productivity growth and bring down domestic costs. These defects should now be immediately redressed. There is no more time to lose. Already, we are very much behind the curve. And my fear is that the Papadimos government, despite the excellence of Papadimos himself, being a pre-electoral government, will also entail a further loss of time in pursuing the radical reforms which are necessary. Which are these reforms? Privatization, opening up of product, services, and labor markets, deregulation to combat bureaucracy, eliminating waste in the state sector, abolishing unnecessary public entities, should proceed at a fast rate in order to improve the investment climate and create conditions for sustained economic recovery. An EU-led investment drive through grants and loans will help to accelerate the pace of recovery. Now, in terms of the development paradigm, there have been quite a few studies recently in Greece. I believe the synthesis of the studies implies a number of sectors which should be promoted and encouraged in the short and medium run. Tourism towards the shifting tourism towards the high end of the market, renewable energy, outward looking agriculture, selected technologically intensive manufacturing are elements of a successful export-oriented strategy which spill over the more traditional sectors such as real estate, construction, and financial services. A return to growth, that's a dream scenario, in conjunction with tight fiscal discipline, will set the economy on a virtuous cycle of lower deficits and interest rates, feeding back to investment, exports, and growth. What is better than that? I don't know. But anyway, I should remind you that during the period when Greece tried to accede into the Eurozone, something approaching this scenario has actually been the case. Now, if that does not materialize, what is the alternative? The alternative is default and eventually exit from the euro. Arguments in favor of returning to a national currency are unsound, and I was happy to see an article by Professor Pissaridis in Kathimerini, which also supports this view, and I thank him for this because he carries great weight in Greece. Devaluation would inflict further and substantial losses in real incomes, another 15% perhaps, on top of those already incurred, and lead to the collapse of the banking system and capital flight of potentially very considerable proportions. Greece's debt position would worsen dramatically on account of the new currency denomination, while inflationary wage rises to compensate for the huge income losses would eventually wipe out the benefits from the devalued currency. Now, it's obvious that higher inflation and interest rates will condemn the economy to prolonged stagnation at depressed levels of output and employment. Social and Western stability would inevitably follow, posing broader geopolitical risks such as those I described before. Dear friends, the benign scenario I have outlined for a Euro-sustained return to solvency and growth is obviously feasible on two conditions. First, European help, provided the Eurozone leaders put their house in order. Second, a competent, reform-minded government. Greece suffered from very poor governance over the last few years. The outcome of the next elections, due to take place in the spring, is critical for the country's future. The following months will determine economic and social developments for decades to come. Greece's dilemmas are essentially political. The political system, as it is presently structured, seems unable to respond to the challenges. It is too closely tied to the problems it ought to confront. A major realignment of forces is called for within or across parties, so as to create space for a new progressive lineup that would lead the way to recovery in conditions of social justice and inclusion. Thank you very much.
Interesting election. Thank you for covering both the Eurozone dimension and the Greek dimension. I thought you would leave us without any coverage of Greece, but I'm sure we're going to have this coverage also in the questions and answers. We can have a few questions. Please, when asking a question, identify yourselves and try to keep the question as a question and quite short so that we have more time for more contributions from the audience and more answers from our speaker.
Well, I speak as an engineering graduate, and whether I'm dealing with equipment in Germany, France, or Greece, the same rules apply. Now, when you deal with economics, we've already found out the Greeks are different than the Germans, I think that's not me. And I feel that the capitalist system, or the economic system of the world, capitalist doesn't recognise this. It tries to apply mathematical models to the behaviour. age of human beings. And I think it's fair to say the capitalist system goes with boom and bust. And we get the latest bust. If we get a boom after this, we're still there. I mean, so I read recently a book on that, very critical of the economic system. It said, Einstein said that if you use the same method to try and solve a problem that took you to the problem, gave you the problem, you've got the wrong method. And I can't quote anybody higher than that.
I fully agree. Well, the point I wish to make is that, that economics is a human science, so the basis or the foundation of economics is the analysis of human behavior. And this, if you arrive at a good model of human behavior, this will help you to understand much better economic phenomena and the way they evolve over time. So,
are we going to converse to the German behavior? The Greeks ever going to converse?
Whatever happens in Europe, if at the Eurozone, if Greece doesn't reform, it will go backwards because it completely unmodernized, dysfunctional economy. And my biggest worry, looking over what's been happening in Greece over the last 2 years, is that it's unreformable. I mean, you said the Troika asked for too few reforms and too much austerity, but even those few reforms have been put into practice. Nothing.
I said the implementation was in place.
Yes. And I think the reason is not, I don't think we should blame any particular government, and especially the last government for doing it. I think the reason is that politicians are more interested in party politics than in what's good for the country. You know, you had Samaras objecting to policies that are essentially extremely right wing that Papandreou was trying to implement. I mean, that's unthinkable. You try to reform the public sector and you get public sector unions coming out into the streets rioting and breaking up the center of Athens and going on strikes. So how do you reform Greece?
Well, how do you reform Greece? Well, the interpretation go back where you do it over the last 100 years when a few Greek governments have succeeded in reform. Of course, I fully realize how difficult it is, and this has been quite manifest in recent years. But there have been periods when strong governments with a coherent vision and plan have succeeded in convincing people.
Always following a war.
Not necessarily, of course, in a certain way, you know, Venizelos was a reform government, and also Kostas Karamanlis in the beginning was also a reform government, but also Kostas Simitis was a reforming prime minister after 1996 without any kind of war, because this was the period when, at least in the economic sphere, various steps have been taken, both in nationalizing fiscal policy and also promoting privatizations and other structural reforms. So I don't think that if you look at the whole kind of evolution of the Greek society, you could say that it is consistently unreformable. What you need, I think, is a combination of a number of things which are currently missing. First of all, let me remind you that the present government, the last government, lost precious political capital at the beginning through this slogan, Leftai Parti, that money is there. Which corrupted the people by believing wrongly that there was enough money to pay for everything. And then when the government changed tune, first of all, it has lost credibility because it is not very easy to understand why, even after the government deficit was declared to be 12% or 13% of GDP, they still had money. So it lost credibility. And then after a few months, its popularity was starting to fall. So it did sort of miss the political momentum. So one first rule is to have a strong government doing the right things in the beginning of its mandate. And the second thing is that obviously, another reforming prime minister in Britain, Mr. Thatcher, has shown, you have to sustain some fights and win them. I remember when Kostas Simitis attempted to reform the social security system, and there was 1 million people in the streets, he backed up. That was quite a strategic defeat. On the
the other hand, when we tried to enter into the Eurozone and we tried to sell a state bank here in Kitrakesa, again, we had a fight, big fight. The trade unions in those areas sort of, you know, were pretty violent, but we won the fight and we established the principle that the government is able to sell state assets. So I believe it is a matter of the quality of governance to some extent. Although, you know, the resistances are there, but these are the resistances, Professor Tsaridis, is not, dear Chris, is not only a monopoly of Greece. Look at what happens in the States. The States, they do have a debt problem. You see that how many politicians have tried now to address this problem, both in Congress and also President Obama, and doesn't succeed to do so. So resistances is part of the human behavior. Nobody wants to undertake costs, you know, in terms of his living standards. But if you look at the trajectory of humanity over the last 100 years, you will see that many countries, including Greece, have surmounted these obstacles in various points in the time sequence and have succeeded. So I cannot offer any particular prescription, but I would like to convey my belief that Greece's problems are not unsolvable. They are extremely difficult to solve, but I think we can do the job.
Right, so we can take questions in pairs, so I'll start from there and then some the later.
Suggested that the peoples of Europe feel more national than European. And so this when it is you open these decisions to popular acceptance, and you will have lots of resistances that show up, precisely because people do not identify with Brussels or European institutions or other people who decide on their behalf outside the frontiers of their country. However, it's all a matter of explaining to people what is their interest. Because if people realize that in a globalized world, decisions cannot be reached at the national level, and if they continue to insist on reaching decisions on national level, they will eventually pay a very high cost through euro exit, through default of this, that, or the other, then eventually some kind of wider acceptance will be formed. So I would try to repeat the argument, it is a question of the quality of politics and the quality of the persuasion process that eventually will lead to the necessary result. And evidence for this is the development of Europe in the last 60 years. Let us remind ourselves that Europe, during the last century, was fighting two world wars, and tens of millions of Europeans died in the field of wars. And now, after the 50s, a succession of moves have been registered in terms of further integration. What you seem to suggest is that this integration process seems to reach a limit. Of course, only problems will determine the limit of this integration. I agree that this further step is a big step, and I also see myself what you see, also that the peoples of Europe and leaders of Europe are not quite ready to take this step because circumstances have changed too radically for them, but time is pressing and they will eventually be forced to either take this step or collapse. So although I agree that the next step will be a unique step, an exceptional step that we have not seen in past history, I would argue that it may be unique, but still, the next step is another step in a long series of steps that have already been taken and does not deviate from a generally progressive pace of European integration. So I don't think that despite the objections and the reservations you very rightly mentioned, I don't think we are entitled to be absolutely sort of negative or pessimistic about what could happen. I think it is something it is worth fighting for. Of course, if we succeed, time will tell.
The question about the EFSF.
Yes, and the EFSF, of course, yes. The EFSF. Now, I wouldn't entirely agree with your view for a number of reasons. First of all, it is one thing for the ECB to unleash unlimited quantities of money to calm the markets, and in fact, there is no, strictly speaking, a legal reason for not doing so, but it is against the spirit of the European Union Treaty. Because the spirit of the European Union Treaty, as opposed to the Constitution of the United States or of the United Kingdom or other countries, prohibits the central bank from buying directly bonds of the state. So it can only intervene indirectly in the secondary market. So if we allow the ECB to do so with unlimited quantities, some will say that this sort of deviates from the right path, and this might undermine in the medium and longer term the credibility of the European Central Bank in terms of its primary objective, which is fighting inflation. This, of course, is a central banker's argument, and as Jacques Delors used to say, central bankers are a very special type of persons, and they should not always listen to them, but I think there is some truth in that argument. Now, the idea of transforming the EFSF into a bank and allow the EFSF to draw unlimited funds from the ECB in order to do precisely that is, to my mind, more straightforward because it will relieve the ECB from the direct responsibility for contravening something that might be regarded as violation of the spirit of the treaty. And moreover, it will allocate political responsibility for this particular piece of economic policy making, that is bond buying, to a political institution which will be covered by government authority, because the EFSF is not a community institution, it's an intergovernmental agency. So if we agree on the principle that you need to apply overwhelming financial power in order to combat panic and keep the Eurozone economy under some form of control and avoid letting it go out of control, which could be catastrophic for everybody, I believe the EFSF solution, which of course is not first best, or it's not ideal, or it's not something that I or somebody else would have thought about a year or two ago, because our thinking evolves as the crisis evolves. I think it's a reasonable and tolerable solution to address the current problem. And as I said, you know, this is a short-term cure. It's not a long-term cure. Money alone cannot solve the problem. The essential problem, as the lady has suggested and as I have explained, is the lack of trust among the peoples of Europe, and this should be addressed by a further round of institutional reforms, difficult as they may look to us now.
Can I follow this point and taking advantage of my position on the EFSF? Let's assume that the EFSF is actually capitalized and it has the trillions of euros to finance national debt. If at some stage then spreads start going up for the EFSF and you know ratings going down, isn't there the next point the ECB printing money? In other words, isn't this yet another intermediate stage in what is actually the final and only solution, which is the ECB printing money?
To be frank, I don't know. you may be right.
Can I answer this one?
No, but it's thanks for the lady. So I think
First of all, the question about defense policy. I followed this discussion for a very long time, and we have fought and I have fought for this particular guarantee from the European Union, so far as the borders of Greece is concerned. But this, for it to be credible and credible policy to be adopted by Greece and to be followed by Greece, and sort of by this way relieving Greece from the burden of spending so much on defense, hinges on two problems. The first problem is that the European Union has not evolved into a defense union. That is, it doesn't possess a European army or a European armed forces capable of defending the borders of every single member country of the Union. So we don't have the means to ensure that even if the Europeans said that, you know, the borders of Greece are sacrosanct or whatever, that they would be in a position to defend them adequately in case of an aggression from Turkey or some other country. The other thing is that even within NATO and within the European Union, whenever the European Union engages in military activities, it does so on the principle of the coalition of the willing. That is, there is no force to oblige the armed forces of France and the United Kingdom and Germany and Italy to unite and engage in a fight so as to defend the borders of a third country that is suffering from aggression. Look what happened with Libya. With Libya, basically two countries concurred, which is France and UK, and several other countries refused to join forces in order to evict Gaddafi, who was an obviously sort of attractive object of defense so far as the European Union is concerned. So the lack of a European defense force and the absence of a mechanism ensuring the coordination or cooperation of national armed forces in defense of common goals, this to us and to any other country do not provide sufficient guarantees for relieving us from the burden of defending our own frontiers. So what you say is desirable, it is worth fighting for, but so far as the current situation is concerned, unfortunately, it is not the case, and we cannot responsibly base our policies on such notions. Now, the other question was the, I'm sorry, the, oh yeah, technocratic paradigm, yes. Well, first of all, one should not so exaggerate the technocratic content of the present government. Just the prime minister is a technocrat, the rest are politicians, and most of them have served in the previous government. It is not the same with Italy, of course. Mr. Monti is a technocrat and has composed a purely technocratic government. This is just by way of clarifying the situation. Now, whether this suggests a change of paradigm is not very clear to me. It depends on how long it will last and whether it will be generalized to other countries. So far as I can see, I think politics will eventually get the upper hand again. Italy is a special problem because the Berlusconi period had lasted too long and Italy had lost its rank within the European Union, so something had to be done, particularly since it was feared by the other Eurozone leaders that if Italy falls, as compared to Greece, the whole area will fall, while if Greece falls, it's not necessarily the case that the Eurozone will collapse. But if Italy collapses, then it will take the Eurozone with it. So the pressure on the political establishment of Italy to move into the Monti solution was very, very strong. But I don't think that similar pressure can be exercised in other countries or will produce similar results. Now, generally speaking, of course, it is quite obvious, and I think you seem to suggest this in your question, that the credibility of the political systems, or democratically elected political systems in Europe today, has been traumatized very substantially as a result of the crisis. So people are looking for other solutions. Now, whether these other solutions will imply a stronger technocratic element in the formation of governments, or whether it will incite a renewal of political parties with more forward-looking people, with people who are have more technocratic structure and less political criteria or electoral criteria in pursuing their responsibilities, I don't know. Either way, though, something will have to happen, because with the present political leaderships, I don't think that either Europe will survive or the nation states that compose it will have a sort of bright future. So something will happen. But I'm not sure, though, that the technocratic Italian solution is a recipe or a paradigm for other countries to follow. Definitely, I don't think that Greece is the same as Italy, because Papademos is just one technocrat among the political government, and moreover, the time span of the Papademos government is just 3 months. Essentially, it is an extended pre-electoral government instead of a government composed and constructed in order to pursue an ambitious reform agenda, which is precisely what Greece needs now. And lastly, it was about the last question.
Repeat
the last question.
I was basically referring to Akfen's suggestion that during a period of very extreme, in some cases, anti-Europeanism.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yes. Yes.
And then the extra.
Well, I'm tempted to repeat the answer I gave, because the question is essentially the same. That I agree that the resistances and reservations about the European content of future policy is very, very strong, and there are many obstacles to be surmounted. But also one should bear in mind that the problems that Europe faces now, and also the costs of not doing the right thing, are so enormous that perhaps a paradigm shift in European attitudes might take place, which, of course, will be an exceptional progress in terms of what has happened in the past, but not it will not deviate from a long period of progress in terms of European integration that has taken place over the last 60 years. So it will be both novel, but also conventional, in the sense that it will follow an existing positive trend. Now, concerning my friend, sorry?
But is it possible to have such such strong, such huge changes within a period of such economic and social turmoil?
But it is the first time that a European economy faces the risk of collapse, right? Concerning my friend Tasos Yanits, I'm very glad he's back in the government, because despite the huge resistance he faced when he tried to pass the Social Security bill, when the last Social Security bill has passed a year and a half ago, people said that if the Yanitsis reform had been implemented, it would have been much milder and would not necessitate taking such radical measures as Greece has been forced to take now. So in a way, he has been justified by events, and I hope he does a good job in the Ministry of Interior.
A bit louder.
Louder. Why don't you stand up? Have a look at it. Yes.
George Pasoukas, I'm a member of the Hellenic Society here at the LSE. And based on what the gentleman said earlier on the Einstein theory of solutions and problems, given that you are part of the governments which are mainly responsible for Greece's hardship,
not only hardships.
Even worse, yes. I would like to ask you, how can you feel that you have both the credibility and the capacity to be suggesting solutions for the exit of the crisis when you yourself are being part of the problem?
Well, I welcome the question. And I would like to thank you very much for giving me this opportunity to talk about myself, which I usually avoid. Anyway, all I want to say says that it is not generally historically correct to sort of equalize all periods of history and make the same judgments about all periods of history. As a matter of fact, the period from, say, 96 to 2002 was a period of economic progress in Greece, because Greece at that time combined very strong economic performance in terms of investment growth, productivity growth, output growth, employment growth, prosperity growth, without the imbalances that characterized the subsequent period, because during that period, fiscal deficits were under control, external deficits were limited, were only one-fourth of what happened after 2005, and generally the other financial indicators were under control. So with all the conventional measures of economic performance, as was testified by all international organizations, Greece did well. Now, problems essentially, and if you ask me why Greece has entered into this very difficult period, Greece has entered into this very difficult period because after it joined the euro, as I said, reform efforts stopped. And of course, the second more deeper question, in which you may be right, is that if you ask me, was Greece ready to join the euro in the year 2000, I will respond as follows. Greece was ready in terms of all the formal criteria, the famous Maastricht criteria, but only partly in terms of the real substantive criteria, because it had improved its economic performance, as I indicated, but definitely it had not improved, as Chris, Professor Pissarides has suggested before, the institutions that should sustain over a longer term its economic behavior and its economic performance. That is the institution of education, the institution of the health service, the institution of the civil service, the institution of justice remained, unfortunately, unreformed. They were unreformed, of course, you know, we can talk endlessly about this. They remained unreformed, first of all, because the government of the day had to confront an exceedingly difficult economic situation. So the political power we had to be devoted to resolving only the economic problems. We didn't have enough political capital to spend on opening fronts in other areas. And the failure of Mr. Yanitz in social security reform testifies to this. And secondly, because the problems of institutions in Greece, the inefficiency, the bureaucracy, the corruption where it exists, have a very long history. And unfortunately, they need time to be addressed. So that part of the preparation for Europe, for Greece to join the euro, was eventually to take place, you know, during the last decade. But even during the last decade, no effort has been made in that direction, with the result that, you know, with the eruption of the global financial crash, all these problems exploded and led Greece to the present dire state. So it's a very complicated discussion, but turning back to the Greek economy, during the years I was in charge, it performed very well indeed.
Can I follow this up again, Sarah's action, and perhaps ask a bit differently, because you obviously emphasized that the institutional change was not sufficient, and as we know, this is not an easy task anyway, so you cannot really expect...
I would assume a part of responsibility also for the governments, and for I was a that not enough effort has been made to address the problems of institutions in Greece, in justice, health, education, civil service. There are four areas where, in fact, the progress registered not only in the last 8 years, but in the last 30 years, was glaring.
But besides the institutional dimension, I want to ask you whether, on reflection, you would say that not enough effort has also been, emphasis has been placed on economic industrial restructuring, developing the comparative advantages that you talked about in your presentation. And perhaps this was also because of some, you know, the easy growth that happened with financial market deregulation, low interest rates, expansion, credit expansion, this created growth reduced, if you want, helped fiscal consolidation, and then not enough attention perhaps was paid in the real structure of the structure of the real economy and the comparative advantage of the country. Would you say that this is?
Well, you may maintain this. This is, I suppose, a very legitimate criticism to make. However, one should take into account two factors here. The first two facts, right? The first fact is that for an economy to progress in terms of productivity and in terms of real performance, you need a couple of preconditions. First of all, is financial stability. Mm-hmm. This we achieve. The second thing is infrastructure investments, which we did, because during that period of the entry into the Eurozone, the infrastructure investments financed by the party of the European Union have accelerated a lot. And as we all know, the major big projects which have been discussed in Greece for over 40 years have been realized during that decade in the 90s. And the third instrument we have, besides central planning, which was not in our mentality, was all these reforms through privatizations, which have taken place. So, in terms of the fundamental weapons we had to promote structural reform, we used them, definitely not with great success always. We made mistakes. First of all, in privatization, sometimes we have been very timid with all these partial privatizations which have taken place. I suppose more radical action would be needed. Secondly, we didn't promote, for instance, liberalization of markets as much as was necessary. Liberalization of closed professions was also necessary to make them. I didn't do it, so I accept responsibility for this. So, in these areas of structural reforms, several positive steps have been taken, but of course, another bunch of reforms will be necessary and have not been taken. But generally speaking, the conditions for productivity and output growth have been created in terms of the financial stabilization and infrastructure investment, and partly with reforms. And that explains the fact that until 2002 and 2003, the real indicators improved alongside with stability of the financial indicators, which was a measure of success.
Okay, nice set of questions.
Sorry to business analyst at Allmax Scotland Development Office. Given the far-reaching consequences of various options on the table.
Hey, sorry, could you speak more loudly?
Given the far-reaching consequences of the various options on the table for Greece, I do maintain there are several options, perhaps not quite so black and white pictures as you portrayed. Do you think the Greek people have a right to have a referendum on the issue?
Well, the referendum is anyway, I take note that I will write in more clearly.
Yes.
I write in capital letters now.
My name is Angelos Kondilamis.
Why don't you, since you're sitting in a back seat, so.
My name is Angelos Kondilamis. I'm a postgraduate student at the Institute of Social Psychology here at the school. Two very brief points. You spoke a lot about the psychological rationality in the markets. I was wondering if it's indeed psychological rationality or it's a matter of irrational structure. And I mean, I would like your comment on the way that rating companies are dealing with the whole situation and their effect on determining the sustainability of national economies, and also the way that the CDS market
see how you can combine these two. In a way, you combine.
Okay, fair enough. Yes.
So I'll give it to this point. Questions from the lady.
You said that after joining the Eurozone, Greece effectively started to take things for granted. Therefore, do you believe that if Greece had never joined the Eurozone, it would be in a better position today?
That's a problem.
This is a pretty easy question, so.
Yeah. So the first question was referred to the referendum. Look, the referendum, of course, obviously is a democratic event, and so I mean people instinctively are in favor of it. However, the referendum does pose a number of problems because sometimes people do not address the question as it is posed, but they address a different question they wish to answer in a certain conjecture. So the referendum poses a number of risks. That the question is whether it is worth taking in a particular political juncture. My view was the risks were too high, the question was too fundamental within or outside the euro, and the referendum should not take place. And I believe the decision to withdraw the idea was the right one. Moreover, there was a major question of credibility vis-à-vis our European partners. It was wrong to proclaim a referendum without consulting the European leaders, because the European leaders spent a lot of time and energy in order to produce the decisions of October 26. So they didn't particularly like the idea of delegating the response of Greece to those particular decisions after 3 months, depending on the uncertain outcome of a referendum that included many, many, many risks, as I suggested. So the referendum sounds good. It's like the private sector involvement. It sounds good, but does not produce the desired results. Now, the other question concerns the markets and the way they function. I agree with the way you put the question. I think the international markets today are very uncontrolled, and they reflect a fundamental problem. That the globalization of the world economy has proceeded in a very fast way, but regulation and politics did not follow the fast progress in economic and financial globalization. So the structure of supervising and controlling economic activity has not evolved in a way that is adequate for exercising adequate control over the global economy. There is a desynchronization between the process of economic globalization and the process of political globalization. We lack appropriate international institutions for exercising control over the way global markets work. And this is a fundamental problem that explains basically the global financial crisis of 3 years ago, and of course as a byproduct also partly the European financial debt crisis we face today. So it's a very great challenge for the world today and for Europe's leaders and global leaders is to bring those two processes in line. In fact, the report I have written for Friends of Europe, I think Vasilis has a copy, a few months ago, was entitled The Lessons of Eurozone Crisis and Europe's stance and Europe's position in the G20 agenda, in which I tried to explain why all this disjuncture between the global the political globalization and economic globalization should be merged together by having a more aggressive position and aggressive policies in terms of coordination of economic policies and financial policies on a global scale. And an obvious example of such cooperation and coordination should be an adequate supervision of financial markets by creating global institutions to exert control over regulation, over supervision, over new products, over crisis resolution, and other aspects of the markets which work in a very negative fashion so far as global prosperity is concerned. So on this question, I fully agree.
Thank you.
Now, the last question concerns the reform process in the European Union and Greece, and how this reform process can be friendly to the people, because you cannot ask the people just to suffer sacrifices. You should give them something in return, or something to believe in, so as to support the sacrifices necessary to avoid economic and financial collapse. On that score, much needs to be done, because so far no effective answer has been given by political parties, neither in Greece nor in the rest of Europe. To my view, there are two basic questions that need to be addressed. The first question is how to distribute the cost of overcoming the crisis. We talk about tax rises, about tax evasion, about reducing state spending, and so on. So the key question, what differentiates obviously parties of the left and parties of the right, is that parties on the left have to insist much more on combating tax evasion, on distributing the state spending costs in an even basis, on not hitting the social welfare state and hitting waste in the government. This is fundamental. I believe what is happening in the States is a precursor to what would happen in Europe, because in the States, you see, they do have this enormous fiscal problem, and the Republicans insist on keeping all these tax reductions for the rich and hitting on Medicare, on medical, health problems, or health programs, social security, pensions, and other parts of the state, which hit particularly the worst off. So the question of fairness is exceptionally important for giving the people the idea and the conviction that the politicians and the governments care about them. But there is a deeper problem that needs to be addressed. I think politicians should be clear about one thing, that over the next, not few years, but quite a number of years, the output, particularly in Greece, in the indebted countries, but I would say, generally speaking, also in Europe, will be the output growth will be less than what was thought of 5 or 10 years ago. The global economy, the European economy, and definitely the Greek economy will enter a phase in which output levels and income levels will be depressed. Particularly the output of Greece will not be able to sustain the size of the state we had 3 years ago, or we were planning to have in the next 5, 10, or 15 years. You remember all the elections, I remember so far as taking part in them, all political leaders went to the Balkans and said, you know, we promise 5 or 10% increase in pensions, this doubling the spending on university education, or this or the other. This belongs to the past. And Greeks should get the feeling that the economic developments for the next 10 to 15 years will be such that they will have to live with a smaller state, that is, with less income flows from the state, either for subsidies or social spending or even incomes. So what should we promise in return? What we can only promise in return is that we shall make this smaller state, the reduced economy can sustain, a more effective one and more friendly to the citizen. How this can be done? This can be done by introducing into the health system, into the education system, into generally other social welfare systems, much more efficiency and much more friendliness than has been the case so far. Of course, you will ask the obvious question, why this hasn't happened before? It hasn't happened before, I agree, and in fact, you know, the question was right, as was put by some other members, one of you 5 or 10 minutes ago, that the governments of Greece did not attach importance to institutional reform. And the reason they didn't attach importance to institutional reform, of course, is the fact that the problems were enormous, there were 2 centuries old and so on, but also what I said in the last paragraph of my speech is that the political parties in Greece now, the political class of Greece, is too closely tied to the problems it ought to confront, because this inefficient, wasteful, bureaucratic state which is big but does not offer adequate services to the citizens, is the product of the clientelist policies followed by all political parties during the last 20 or 30 years. So to achieve this result, to make a smaller state offer better services and be friendlier to the citizen, we need, in fact, something which is approaching a revolution in Greece. And I agree with Chris that, you know, reforming the state is an exceptionally difficult task. And of course, you know, we can only be very skeptical as to whether the Greek political class, as it is at least presently structured, technocratic or political, can respond to the challenge. But only by promising the people of Greece better services with less resources and be convincing that the answer will be listened to, this is the only way, and I agree with you, with the person who, the gentleman who asked the question, that we can take the people with us in enduring the 10 years of austerity, let's put it like this, of difficulties that lie ahead of us. But the truth must be told. The next 10 years will be difficult years for Greece under whatever scenario we choose, the benign one or the catastrophic one, much more, and that to go through those 10 years, we need a much more effective government or governments that will look at this side of the problem to improve the institutions and make them offer real services to the citizen. Of course, if you compare Greece to other countries in the north of Europe, you see that, in theory at least, the margin for improvement in Greek services is enormous. If you compare, for instance, the Finnish education system with the Greek education system, where the Finns have, in terms of population, 1/4 of the teachers we have in Greece, but they are first best in the world in terms of academic performance. So the area and the field for progress is there. The question is how to capture it. We have the problem of the political class. We also have the problem that improving the services, the social services, the services being a labor-intensive branch of the economy, you have to re-educate the people who work in the services, to re-educate the nurses, to re-educate the teachers, to improve the quality individually of those people who are there. But definitely the start should be made now. There is no more time to lose. And I believe that the political force, in Greece at least, that will capture at least a degree, a minimum degree of trust among the people, is the political force that will convince people that it is serious about engaging upon this fight. Fairness, on the other hand, in distributing the costs, but more fundamentally, credible promise that the quality of services rendered to the citizen will improve. Thank you very much.
Questions, but we are out of time. Thanks again for the presentation.
Thank you very much for your attention.